Hey, everybody, if you're in the New York area this coming Monday, May the 22nd, I will be co-hosting a screening of Very Semi-Serious, which is a HBO documentary film about the cartoon department at the New Yorker magazine. It follows the life of the editor of the cartoon department, Bob Mankoff, and a bunch of other cartoonists and his personal life as well. It's a very, very fun and funny documentary. In fact, this screening on Monday night kickstarts my screening series called Docularius, and we're going to be at DCTV, who's co-hosting the event. DCTV is at 87 Lafayette Street, just a block or two south of Canal Street in Manhattan, in a converted firehouse. They've been there forever. They're old friends of Filmwax and myself, and I'm very, very excited that we'll be doing the screening and relaunching the Docularius film series for the low price of $6 for members and $10 for non-members. If that weren't enough, you get to meet four cartoonists from The New Yorker, including Bob Mankoff himself. He'll be there on Monday night at DCTV, along with Liana Fink, Emily Flake, and Mort Gerberg. So, again, doors at 6:30, screening at 7. We'll be there having a good time. And, you know, listen, bring a sketch. Could it hurt to submit it right there? I mean, you know, so why not get some feedback? And then we'll be hanging out and have a reception after the Q&A. So, again, join me Monday night, May 22nd at DCTV, 87 Lafayette Street in Manhattan. And now, on with the show. Hey everybody, new sponsor for the show, Magic Drop. Magic Drop is a music licensing business based in Brooklyn, New York, which represents an eclectic roster of bands and composers licensing their music for use in films, TV, and beyond. Magic Drop works directly with clients to find songs or instrumentals from a catalog of 1,000-plus tracks by artists with distinctive developed voices. Magic Drop offers competitive rates and festival licenses for independent filmmakers. Visit magicdropmusic.com or email contact at magicdropmusic.com for more information. Again, that's Magic Drop. I welcome them to the podcast. Welcome, everyone. This is Adam Chartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio. You're listening to episode 407. I'm still so geeked, so happy that all my technical issues have been ironed out. You know, again, a couple of weeks there, it was touch and go with a new website that the show's feed is on. But now go to rooftopfilms.com and check out what a beautiful website they've got. My show's on the blog area. You got to visit the schedule because this weekend, starting tomorrow night, Friday, March the 19th, begins the official 21st season of Rooftop Films. And I'm really plugging away because I got to tell you, every year they start their summer series off with This Is What We Mean by Short Films, which is a collection of outstanding short films. And I'm not going to go into all of them again. I did on the last episode. I do want to mention one friend of mine, Nathan Truesdell, will be there with his short. It's called Balloon Fest. So special shout out to Nathan. Congratulations on that. The event will take place at the Old American Can Factory, 232 3rd Street in Brooklyn. Doors at 8 o'clock. Live music by, again, I'm not going to try to pronounce this, INNOV. GNAWA. Film begins at 9 o'clock, then at 10:30 there's an after party sponsored by Corona Extra, Tanqueray, Fever Tree, Tonic, and Frisianet. Rooftop Films. You can go to rooftopfilms.com for tickets. Anyway, and then on Saturday night, the 20th of May, there's a free screening of Band-Aid, Zoe Lister-Jones's new film. By the way, Zoe Lister-Jones was on this very podcast. Check out episode number 323 with Zoe when she released her film Consumed. Well, this is a new film. It's called Band-Aid. It's about a band, and then they're going to perform afterwards. And it's going to take place at the House of Vans, which is at 25 Franklin Street in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. Doors at 7. Film begins at 8:30, 10 o'clock post-screening Q&A with Zoe and Adam Pally. And then 10:30 live music from Zoe and Adam. It says here, in the event of rain, the show will be held indoors at the same location. No outside alcohol is permitted. Listen, RSVP right now. Go to Rooftop Films and take care of business. In the meantime, That's your Friday and Saturday. Take Sunday off, take a breather, and then Monday night again, like at the top of my show, I said, come to my screening of Very Semi-Serious. Don't, you know, if you go to HBO with your parents' login and watch it that way, first of all, you're not going to see it on a big screen and surrounded by other people laughing. And secondly, the cast is going to be at my screening, for God's sake. So come on down to DCTV again. I can't tell you enough how much I want to meet people that are listening to my show. And I'll be there doing my Q&A with Bob Mankoff, Emily, Liana, and Mort. Okay, now on with episode number 407. What do we got here? We have two segments today. I'm not going to talk at great length about them because you can just listen to them. One is Steve James is, listen, I love Steve James. I love his films. This is one of the most talented documentary filmmakers out there today. You know, there was from Stevie, where he was like a big brother to this young man who was a troubled inner city Chicago, I believe. I'm just riffing because I could have some little factual errors. But then to Hoop Dreams. Okay, when I saw Hoop Dreams in the 90s, I was blown away. Who would think, you know, like 25 years later or so, I would be like friends. You know, and when I say friend, I don't mean like I go over for dinner, but we're friends. Like we hang out, we chat whenever Steve's in town. And I can't believe that I just take it for granted at this point. But this is one of my favorite documentaries and one of America's favorite documentaries ever. Hoop Dreams, for God's sake. The Interrupters, unbelievable, right? Life itself, about Roger Ebert, and there's a bunch more, just on and on. Check out his entire slate of films. There's not a bad egg in the bunch. And now he has a new documentary called Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. Anyway, I went down to the Museum of Chinese in America, which is in Chinatown here in New York City, just yesterday, and I met with Steve and the subjects of his film, the Sung family, which is a Chinese-American family. They own and operate a chain of small banks called Abacus for the Chinese-American community in various place spots, and they were actually prosecuted. I'm not going to tell you more about it because you're going to find out at length in this coming segment about this documentary, which is opening on tomorrow, Friday, the 19th, in theaters in New York and LA and elsewhere. So, and we'll have all that information on our show notes. Steve was on episode number 223 for a nice long, I think we had an hour long chat right around the time Life Itself was coming out. And so I welcome Steve back on the show. I'm very excited to have him back on finally, all these episodes later. And he is being joined by the Sung family and the father, patriarch, Thomas Sung, as well as three of his daughters, Vera, Jill, and Chantrell Sung. And so I'm very excited about that. And of course, Steve himself. So that's coming up in a moment. And then I'm finally able to post this episode of my conversation with this young filmmaker named Cameron Bruce Nelson, who I spoke to almost, I think it was about 2 years ago. I think it was 2 years ago. I was a juror at the Nashville Film Festival 2 years ago, and I spoke to this young guy about his film called Some Beasts. And finally, there's going to be a screening tonight as I post this show. I'm trying to get it up in time so people have an opportunity to go see Some Beasts at the Spectacle Theater in Williamsburg. And support this young filmmaker. And also, the cast of this film are friends of mine, some of whom have been on the show. The cast includes Frank Mosley, who will be in an upcoming episode. I'm going to wait until Some Beasts hits platforms, digital platforms. Then I'm going to post a couple of other interviews from the film, including one with Frank Mosley, the actor and filmmaker, Frank Mosley, good friend of mine, as well as Heather Kafka, who has been on the show before and who I have another episode ready to go as soon as Some Beast again hits those platforms. So I'm not going to tell you much about it now. In between the introduction to the second segment, I will come back and I'll give you a little bit of information about that. But it is playing tonight at the Spectacle Theater, which is located at 124 South 3rd Street near Bedford Avenue. Cost for this screening, $5. How do you beat that? Tickets are available. Go to the Spectacle website and purchase tickets for Some Beasts, which again I saw at the Nashville Film Festival, and it's finally having its New York premiere this evening. Now let's get into my first segment here again with Steve James and the Sung family around this new documentary. Again, it's called Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, opening tomorrow, Friday.
Today, we are announcing the indictment of a federal savings bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy. A federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
If you are going to pick on a bank, family-owned company, wedged between a couple of noodle shops in Chinatown, is about as easy a target as you could possibly pick.
When I was a lawyer, there was no bank owned by Chinese and serving the Chinese.
When I walk around here, I feel very much at home. This is a very tasty noodle shop.
That's always special. That's the butt.
When we were children, my dad was excited about this bank he was going to start.
We serve people who've never even dealt with the banking system before.
This whole ordeal began in 2009.
One of our loan officers stole money.
He was lying all over the place.
He was running a money laundering operation. I fired him that day.
They went straight to their regulator and they told them about it.
The DA's office started asking us questions.
Wait a minute, maybe we're the target.
If that prosecution goes through, that bank is going to go out of business.
Although this is David versus Goliath, they're a whole family of lawyers.
We spent a lot of time investigating and ended up absolutely convinced that the loan department was corrupt through and through.
They routinely falsified mortgage documents.
Reporters in this town were treated to this extraordinary photo opportunity. This almost Stalin.
We're at the Museum of Chinese in America at MoCA, right here in Chinatown, in New York City, with filmmaker Steve James returning to my podcast. When last we met, it was in a hotel room. Let's just leave it there. We had a nice conversation. And then I'm pleased to also be joined by some of the subjects of the film, the Sung family. And it's okay, Mrs. Sung, she dropped something. It's okay, no problem. And I'll introduce y'all, and then we'll get into it. Chantrell and Jill and Vera. Yes. Sung, got it. And Father Thomas is around somewhere. He's going to maybe drop in a little while. So we'll start. The name of the film is Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. What Abacus is, well, let's just get right into it. Since you're holding the mic, Vera, let's start. What is Abacus, by the way?
Abacus is...
I'm playing devil's advocate.
Okay.
Or devil's abacus. Okay.
What is abacus? Abacus, objectively, mm-hmm. is an object. It's a calculator. The oldest
right.
computer
yes.
created, I
right.
think. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then subjectively, it was used as a name to name our bank. My father chose it because he felt it represented a certain amount of history and precedent and
right.
gravitas to the financial institution that he created, Abacus Bank.
And it's located in Chinatown in New York.
Yes.
Where it has been for how long?
It's over 30 years uh-huh. in existence. And we have six branches. A couple in, two in Chinatown, one in Chinatown, mm-hmm. one in Philadelphia, one in Flushing, one in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, and one in Edison, New Jersey.
In Edison, really?
Yes. Mm. We're basically, where there's, yes, there's a concentration.
Large Chinese American community
yeah.
there?
Yes.
Okay. My dad's brother lived there for many years. I grew up going to Edison. I didn't. All my childhood.
Oh, you did?
So, for all I know, drove right by it.
Right.
Although I'm assuming they came later in the picture, some of those branches.
Yes, they did. You know. Yeah.
That's... But the point is right, it's been this establishment, this institution serving the Chinese-American community for decades.
Yes.
Right?
Over three decades, yes.
Right. And then in 2008, we had a bit of a financial meltdown in this country, to say the least, where several financial institutions were clearly playing with our money and potentially breaking a lot of laws, and also needed bailouts, everything, right? And then out of all that and all those major banks that were participating in that, the government went after one bank or ended up litigating against one bank.
Right.
Is that fair? It was your bank.
Yes.
Hence the film.
Right.
So, Steve, I know that this was brought to you by your friend Mark here, right? This story.
Friend. I don't know if I'd use the word friend.
Acquaintance?
No. Of course, yes. He's a friend, yes, and a colleague.
So you found out about this story, or he brought it to your attention, and what was it that was so compelling to you? Guys are clearly
Well, I've always liked Chinese food.
Story.
number Fair one. What was compelling about it, you said you're going to edit, so.
Me.
Yeah. Oh.
So I don't make mistakes, not you.
Okay. What was compelling about it was just hearing initially about, you know, when Mark first talked to me about it, he said, you know, I know this family in New York. I've known them for 10 years. They have this bank. They're the only bank being criminally prosecuted,
right,
connected to the 2008 mortgage crisis. And I'm like, what? And they're a small community bank. And he said, and, you know, I really think they're innocent. And he started to give me some of the details about how they had self-discovered some low-level fraud going on.
In the mortgage department.
In their own mortgage department.
Right.
How they'd reported it, how they'd fired the guy, reported it, initiated their own internal investigation and got rid of a few other people. And yet the DA's office decided that the bank was complicit in all of this and decided to put them on trial, and that this was this five-year ordeal. So Mark told me all this, and I was like, this just sounds insane. And then he said, and Matt Taibbi, in his book, The Divide,
Rolling Stone,
wrote about their indictment, because when the book came out, the trial had not happened, but wrote about their indictment in the introduction to his book as a kind of exhibit A of the unequal application of justice in America. And so he said, you know, you should read that, and he gave me the book. And I read that chapter, and I just said, well, yeah, I see why this is. And, you know, on top of all of that, it was like, and no one's reporting on, I mean, I hadn't heard about it. I read the New York Times with some regularity, and it was like, I don't know anything about it. So all of that combined said, well, yeah, let's go to New York and film a little bit and see if there's a film to be done here. And clearly there was.
Chantrell. Why do you think Cyrus Vance Jr., right? Wasn't Cyrus Vance Sr. a good guy? Wasn't he a good guy? I remember him. He was like the VP, right? Wasn't he under
Secretary of State.
Oh, he was the Secretary of State under Ford?
Carter.
He's one of the good guys, I thought. Anyway, doesn't mean that he's not. It doesn't mean Cyrus Vance Jr. isn't, but he doesn't get our sympathy in this. I'm wondering why Abacus Bank. Would you have, I mean, you guys must have a theory after all that. Sure.
And we're asked that question a lot as if there's some sort of complicated answer, but I really think it's quite simple. It was basically an example of going after the little guy, but it was all about politics. At that point, there was no other financial institution that had been charged criminally after the financial crisis. And
it was like, could have been like shooting fish in a barrel, but they went after...
This was a case that we actually brought to them. They had initially, before we even retained an attorney to represent the bank, they had asked my sisters to come in, to provide documents and to come in for interviews to the district attorney's office to explain how the bank operated and so forth. And so, you know, at that point, as Steve had mentioned, an internal investigation by the bank had already been conducted. And my sisters had hired a forensic auditor to conduct that investigation and had provided that evidence to the Manhattan DA's office, thinking that they were going to then do what's right and actually prosecute the bad guys. But instead, it turned into what you now know as this story.
And forgive, I'm asking a lot of questions as though I haven't seen the movie or know the story, but a lot of people that are listening will hopefully see the film, but maybe haven't yet. I have a question, Jill. Do you think the government just assumed this was going to be like just a slam dunk?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I don't think they thought that there would be any kind of fight that's put up by us. I think they also thought that as a being a bank, that we would be a small bank, that we would be nervous and be concerned about our regulatory issues with having this indictment against us. So I think they definitely thought that that would be easy.
Well, we're being joined by the patriarch of the family.
Thank
you very much, Thomas Song.
Yes.
And so, Thomas, let me ask you, there's a lot of questions come to mind. One I want to definitely ask you is, what did you think when maybe it was Mark Mitten came to you saying, I have this friend named Steve who makes films, and he's interested in, was that kind of how it went?
I think it's Mark, and then Mark introduced Stephen.
Hold the mic a little closer.
To us.
Thank you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What was your first thought about or feeling about a film being made about this story, especially when you had no idea how it was going to turn out?
Well, truthfully, we always felt that we have a we have been unfairly prosecuted. Having a recording of the events, to me, is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I welcome the opportunity, in fact.
Steve, did you talk to him about there's going to be an aspect to the film that might get personal, that you're going to be inside their family discussions right in the middle of that, and maybe in their home, and it could get quite intimate, right?
Yeah, I mean, we made it clear that we didn't just want to interview them about the case or check in with them, that we wanted to be around when they were
processing
and dealing with it. I mean, you know, there were boundaries. Jill, despite my persuasive charms, did not allow us to film with her family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kept coming back to that, didn't I? Saying, come on, are you sure? Just a little bit, you know, because we did want to see them apart from the office and the dealing with the trial to some degree. Not a lot, but some degree. But, you know, it's fine that we didn't get that, and we were totally respected her reasons for not wanting that. But they were very cooperative and game for us to be there to sort of see this process that they were going through and sort of witness it up close, which is good because that is the heart of this film. You know, we weren't able to be in the courtroom. We tried. We weren't able to get access to the prosecution during the trial. We tried. We weren't even able to get access to the defense team during the trial, and we really tried with that.
Sure.
So what we were left with, and I put that in quotes, is the family. But you know what? That really was the heart of really understanding what this was about and what it meant was to be with the family. And thankfully, they gave us that access.
What was the defense? What was their biggest concern about somehow participating in the film?
You guys should add to this, but my impression from our conversation with them was that they just felt like it was that they worried that any kind of film, even though the film wasn't going to come out until long after this was decided, that it could present some kind of problem with us being there to record it. It could in some ways undermine the confidentiality between client and lawyers. Honestly, I know because there's been a number of films done that have access to parties during the trial that really isn't a real that there's ways to deal with that would never come to pass, but we weren't able to convince them of that, and they're the lawyers, so they decided that they didn't want it.
Well, to the film's credit, it didn't occur to me, why isn't the defense team speaking up here? Why don't we have them in the
And I think that's good to hear. And I think part of that is because the family is so engaged in this process with each other that it more than fills any void there'd be there. And it's compelling and it's different.
Mm-hmm.
It's different to sort of see a family going through this in the way you see that in a film, whereas typically you see lawyers involved in every aspect of it.
Right. And it makes sense, the bank, even though it's a financial institution, it's a family business. You know, you don't see that too often. And it kind of brings me back to that point. I'm glad it came up because what we see in the film also at the sort of towards the beginning is father and the founder of the bank, Thomas, really involved in the neighborhood. He's really part of the community and really visible. He makes himself personally liable by being visible. I don't mean legally necessarily viable to the problems that may occur, but he's there. He's taking, you know, ownership of his business and of his relationships, and it's really refreshing. It's particularly difficult to watch his name being questioned and his name to be dragged through the mud like that. And I can't imagine, I was feeling so much tension and anguish empathizing with you ladies about what that must be like to see your dad going, and we see it in the film, what you're going through, but I don't know if you can articulate, looking back now a year or two when this was unfolding.
It's hard to believe it's been 2 years already.
Yeah.
Time really flies, but the pain and the anguish that you talk about is very real. Each one of us as his daughter, we don't want to disappoint him, and we also don't want to see him get hurt in any way, just as he is very protective of us. So in going through this trial, it's very personal in mm-hmm. that sense. We knew we were fighting for the community and for the bank, but we also know that we were also trying to fight for something that our father had devoted his entire life, well, not his entire life, but a good part of his life in building.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely want to make sure that that legacy survives and continues.
Did you have anything to add to that, Jill?
I think that was good.
Chantrell, did you have anything to add? Let's hear from Thomas again, Mr. Sung. Excuse me. Let's hear from Mr. Sung again. You're a pretty cool character. I don't think I saw you sweat once. I mean, your wife is falling apart. Your daughters are crumbling, and you know everybody is trying to keep their selves together. But you look very, very together through the whole time. Was there any moment or moments in there where you really just had given up hope?
Well, as I get older, you become more immune to different possible events in life. And, of course, this is one of the most difficult ones that we've experienced, particularly when you are almost at the retirement age, actually beyond retirement age.
I think you are beyond.
I'm sorry to say that.
Yeah.
And you have this thing coming at you.
your wife is gesticulating behind you.
So you had this thing, this indictment come at you totally in the sense that you cannot anticipate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In banking, we anticipate risks. That's part of the banking, bank's responsibility.
Right.
We anticipate various different risks. One of the risks is regulatory risk. But really never anticipated prosecutorial risk.
Mm-hmm.
That's something never experienced before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for good reason. When a financial institution is prosecuted, indicted, that's the beginning and the end, not like a normal criminal case. It's the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But daughters who did the research will tell you no bank survived the indictment.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yes,
wow.
not more than 3 months anyway, right? Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, usually the regulator either pulls the plug. Well, most of the times they pull the plug.
They take away the charter. Guarantee in the charter. Okay.
Yeah, they work. It's almost like a pre-arranged.
I see.
Between the regulator and the
then.
And the bank.
Right.
So yeah, my father's correct. This was completely unprecedented, and but we felt that. My father was talking about risk, and I'm nodding my head vigorously because that's all I do my whole day. Is in my job as the bank president, is I have to constantly assess risk.
Risk management.
Yeah, and but when we looked at the risk of going to trial versus the risk of taking a plea that was completely untrue, we felt that the risk to the institution was much greater. Actually, was fatal if we took the plea. And we felt that going to trial, because us being lawyers and having some faith in the system, would be able to prove ourselves, was actually a risk that we should take and that was important to take.
Did you want to add to that, Thomas? Good.
Yeah, I just want to finish the thoughts. So, yes, this risk, or prosecutorial risk, it was never anticipated. We know it's a horrendous risk. It's a life and death risk to be indicted. But there was no choice. They want you to either go through the trial. They don't. They really don't want you to go through the trial. They just want you to die.
Mm.
But we felt that we have to move on and defend the case. So, in that respect, they took the risk away from you because there's no choice for us. We had to fight. But to answer your question, how is that we feel so calm about it in approaching the thing here?
No, that's I just asked how you did.
Yes. that may appear to be so, but really we went through a lot of emotional up and down, a lot of agony, because after the indictment, there were successive other prosecutorial actions taken by Vance, such as freezing the bank's asset as if the bank was a ordinary criminal that would have a flight risk taking the property and abscond, you know. And that's hardly is the case with a federally insured institution. So we know we were on the right, but yet again we have to constantly think about what would we do if the action was brought by the DA to freeze our asset. Should we allow him to freeze our assets or a portion of our assets, or should we fight it? If we fight it, are we correct as fiduciary of the bank in taking that risk? All of these things constantly go through our mind and Jill and Vera's mind and so forth, because they clearly was wrong in exerting that power to freeze a federally insured institution. And we were almost ready to give them a small amount of money. To us, it's big money.
Sure.
To them, it's a small amount of money, such as, what, $2 million? Yeah. You know, something like that. They wanted $6 million to freeze. But they want to put in their own account, not in the escrow account. Isn't this, you laugh. This is honest truth.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we said
no go.
We said no go.
No way.
If you lose, if we win the case, how are we going to come to ask you to give us the money back? Right. So our regulator sort of to back up us up a little bit on this point, I believe. But anyway, they gave up on exerting that.
Thank goodness.
That risk.
Anyway, I know that we have to wind down. So I just want to thank the Sung family for being so open and sharing their story here, and to Steve James for telling the story so sensitively and dramatically. I mean, it's the film, which again is called Abacus, the subtitle of which is Small Enough to Jail, and it's going to be having its theatrical later this week, Friday, the 19th, at the IFC Center in New York City and at the Landmark New Art in Los Angeles.
Well, it's going to be other places.
It's going to be dozens of other places the Steve James moniker. Plus Motto Pictures, my old camp friend Julie Goldman. You've got Motto Pictures. You've got our friends at Cartemquin Films behind the film.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of powerful
people behind this.
A lot of pedigree. Everybody but do you think at your
everybody
opening night,
but Cyrus Vance Jr.
Do you think he's going to be coming to see the film? I think he will.
I hope he brings a big group of people from the DA's office. There's a lot of ADAs over there, right, Chanterelle?
Well, I know, Steve, you got to run, so thank you very much. It's great to see you again.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
Thank you all. It was real a pleasure and honor to meet everybody here. Thank you very much. And thank you to the Museum of Chinese in America. Thank you very much. Again, Cameron Bruce Nelson's film Sunbeast, opening tonight at the Spectacle Theater in Williamsburg, 124 South 3rd Street, right off Bedford Avenue. If you haven't been to the Spectacle, go check it out. It's a nice little micro cinema. The film is, Sal, played by Frank Mosley, has left modern society. He's like the contemporary Henry David Thoreau. So he's left modern society, his past, and his girlfriend to live off the land in remote Appalachia as a caretaker and a gardener. But is this remote living freedom, or is it some other kind of self-imposed prison? Sal struggles with the isolation of his new job. Again, the film co-stars Lindsay Burge, who's been on the show before, and Heather Kafka, who's also appeared on Film Wax Radio and who will be in another upcoming episode. And I got to get Lindsay Burge on. By the way, I just had seen her in Nathan Silver's new film, Thirst Street. She was terrific in that. I said, I got to bring her back with Nathan. I think that's going to have to happen. Bring the two of them on back on the show. It'll be like Nathan's fourth or fifth time on the show, and we'll bring Lindsay back on. But anyway, she's in this film. It's called Some Beasts. Go check it out. If you can't make it to tonight's screening, wait, and I'll keep you appraised. You know, connect with all my social media so that way you can keep appraised. I really enjoyed this film when I saw it. You can visit somebeast.com to keep in touch and subscribe to the newsletter and keep in touch with the film so you too can see it. Now, let's go into my conversation with filmmaker Cameron Bruce Nelson.
This is really great, Sal.
Look at this. Yeah, I know. It's amazing what they've done with this.
Look at the kale.
Look at this. You see this, Riley? Look at this. It's beautiful. Look. You can actually eat it right off. Hmm? Hmm? You want some? Here. Some? It's a rite of passage.
You're crazy.
Stick that in your pocket for later. See anyone over here? Riley, come here.
Yeah, I'll follow you.
Look at this. It's snowing, and look at those flowers are still in bloom. Isn't that cool? Isn't that cool? Let's go take a look here. Come on in.
How you doing?
Oh. Hello.
Hey, Renee.
Hey.
How are you doing?
Good. Welcome. Good to meet you.
Heard a lot
Thank
about
you.
Her.
Hey, Riley.
Just got our first 5-star review from Verite Film Magazine.
Uh-huh.
Which is a UK-based publication.
Yeah. Where did they see it?
They saw it in Nashville.
Oh,
so it's
okay.
Nice that that we had our first Nashville review be such a glowing review.
That is very glowing. 5 out of 5 stars. We're hoping it's a 5 out of 5, not 10, right?
Yes, that's correct.
You are listening to Cameron Nelson, who is the director of Some Beasts. Is this your first feature?
This is my first feature.
Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you.
Pleased with it?
I am very proud of it.
Oh, good.
Very proud.
That's nice to hear. Uh-huh.
It's gone through a long, long journey.
Gestation period or whatever?
Yeah. I lived on the farm for 3 years and then moved to Texas and then wrote the script.
Uh-huh.
And then we spent 3 years making the film.
Right. Okay. So people get the context of what you're talking about. The name of the movie, Some Beasts, right? It's having its, is it a world premiere
mm-hmm.
here at Nashville? No.
It's kind of a co-world premiere with Dallas and Nashville.
Oh, it's the same, on the same, how would you put it, weekend or?
Yeah, it was. Timeline? They kind of crossed over each other. So
yeah, are we in the same time zone?
I'm actually not sure is Nashville in Eastern? Is it Eastern time here?
No. We're one over, so it's Central.
So yeah, so we're Central here.
All right. And then is that Dallas?
Dallas as well.
Mm-hmm. Is Dallas Central time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So just to be sure, you never know. Maybe on a technicality, you know, one was clearly they play the same day. How does it work?
Actually, we played the 10th and the 15th in Dallas, and then the 17th and 21st in Nashville.
Oh, no comparison. So Dallas clearly in the premiere.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. And if you hear a voice in the background, that belongs to producer Mark. What's your last name?
AD Howell.
Oh, AD. Excuse me. AD, assistant director for Mark Howell. So we're at Nashville Film Festival, and we're chatting. Let me turn that fan off, actually, that thing, Ben.
Yeah, sure.
All right, well, let's get to the little bit of the backstory of the film. It's a little warm in here, I apologize. But let's get into the backstory of the film a little bit so people know what this is. First of all, I also want to mention that two of your stars, starring performers, have been on the have sat for interviews for the podcast, but I have not posted them yet. And I don't know if they'll be posted before this, but I'm sure both have mentioned Some Beasts in those conversations. One with Frank Mosley, who's your lead actor. I don't think there's barely a shot without Frank in it. And Heather Kafka, who is his love. And it takes place on, it's about, I think the description that I read was very good. It was, you know, a Thoreau-like self-imposed.
Self-sufficient.
Well, I'm sorry, self-imposed exile kind of situation where he's living in a, is it in Virginia? Tell me where it is.
It's in Southwest Virginia.
Okay.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Southwest Virginia or South, Southwest Virginia?
Southwest Virginia.
Okay, in the state of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, right, and he's a caretaker. They've got, a, you know, during the winter for several farms, right?
Yes. Yeah, for four farms in the film.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he lives on one of them in a work trade situation.
Okay. And but it, it is all about his being, he's not comfortable in, you know, obviously, on a social level. And so this is sort of him, like, but he's also seems to be prone to a certain level of melancholy.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it is that he's sort of trapped between two worlds. And there is his past that he is, you know, he can be either living in the past or sort of planning for the future, but he never really is enjoying the present. And I feel like that's sort of what we see, the inner conflict in him, is that there's this answering machine that is almost this portal back to the old world.
Yeah.
And he, it's almost like this constant tether to him, kind of trying to pull him back, whereas he wants to move on and sort of with this very intentional existence out there. You know, I mean, when you want to live on the land, you have to be completely 100% there. And I feel like that was sort of the conflict of the story, was that, you know, you have kind of this constant reminder of the past that he left behind and a past that's not completely willing to let go.
Mm-hmm. And Heather Kafka plays this woman in his life who is, it's part of what you just described also. She's just another component in that struggle and that conflict of whether to connect or to you know, to really... go outside of himself and commit to this relationship of the single mother. I mean, she herself has her own issues, but she has a daughter, you know, and in a situation that she you set up as the writer where mm-hmm. she can't really just leave and go move down to the Virginia. So, right, she's up in...
she's in Texas.
Oh, she's down in Texas. Excuse mm-hmm. me. She's further southwest. Yeah, so it's really great. And then Lindsay Bird shows up later on, I guess in the spring. I don't know. I'm guessing,
uh-huh.
I don't know.
Yeah.
as one of the... maybe the one where he's living. The farm he's living on?
Yes. He sort of takes over the land, Acourt's land,
right.
Okay. As the caretaker and kind of continues.
Yeah.
And Acourt is the old man in the film.
Yeah.
And he sort of caretakes his land. And then Lindsay comes in, and who is his niece in the film, and also claims stake to the land. So there's a little conflict over who the rightful owner is and if we can even own land, and it's kind of raising those questions.
Lindsay also has been on the show. It's nice to... Lindsay was on a show
she's,
for a
she's
teacher.
Wonderful. She's awesome.
Yeah. So I think Acourt was the only one who's not...
Yeah, Acourt isn't, no.
Is it an unusual name? It's A apostrophe C-O-R-T?
Mm-hmm. I believe it's French, actually.
Uh-huh. Like short for Avoncourt or something like mm-hmm. that, maybe? It's like a... maybe. Right, it's abbreviated.
Yeah, it's Acourt. I think is usually Acourt. How they usually say it, but Acourt insisted that that's how he goes by Acourt with the hard T on the end.
So. Well, you know, it's one of those things which we kind of bastardized it or anglicized. I don't know the Americanized it in its pronunciation, and it makes more sense to pronounce it that way anyway. I suppose.
Yeah,
what's really coming down?
It's kind of nice, like for the with the movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the little atmosphere, right? Because it's always snowing or raining at this part of the country at this time of the year that it takes place. It's a little dreary and beautiful, mm-hmm. gothic, but American gothic, I should say, but really a bit of a, I don't know, I would have a hard time and struggle.
It sets the mood.
Yeah, right.
And especially in our film, like we used a lot of the landscape and the weather to sort of reflect how the character was
His
feeling.
His internal landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it was great to see Frank. It was just one more time, Frank, who listens to this show, so I don't want him to get too big ahead, but it was really refreshing because I've seen him in many movies in small roles, so it was nice to see him in, you know, to really be the lead actor in something that really optimized his talent, and, you know, it was nice.
Yeah, I always felt like he had it in him, and because he and I worked on a short film together called New Animal, and it was actually the film where he and I sort of developed that very subtle gesticulation, yet it says basically like what a paragraph of exposition could say, sort of like in a small facial movement. And I really sort of zoomed in and found that he has this ability to express subtly, which is something that I really appreciate in performances, being such a big fan of, you know, some of the 1970s European cinema where there's not a whole lot said, but there's a lot that comes across just artfully and sort of the visual expression. And some of the 70s American cinema, like Tulane Blacktop, for example, it's like, you know, talk about not very much dialogue or you know, have to go along with the story, mm-hmm. Just be along for the ride. And
certainly, I think, yeah, Monty Hellman actually is the inventor of mumblecore. Years before the Duplass brothers or Joe Swanberg.
Sure.
I'm Monty Hellman did do this podcast too. So
oh,
I just
wow.
keep plugging myself here, but it's pretty amazing. Yeah, recently I got to talk to him about that, about his actors and, you know, in that movie. And yeah, he was really generous.
Did you talk to him about his double release on Criterion,
yes.
the shooting and Ride the Whirlwind?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Man, that's beautiful.
Kind of, yeah. Well, yeah, that kind of allowed the opportunity because he said, yes, he would do it. Just, you know, see those films first so we could talk about it because they were just released by Criterion. Yeah, terrific stuff.
But that was sort of the vein that we were sort of trying to hit with some beasts and,
yeah.
you know, trying yeah. to find that, you know, like I don't know if I said this in the Q&A, but Bob Rafelson is a huge influence. And like King of Marvin Gardens, mm-hmm. when they go explore Atlantic City, you know, the reason why he wanted to do that was because it was sort of like this ideal of the American dream, yet it's like completely dilapidated and exploring these American backwaters that once stood for something and now are something completely different, and just exploring those through cinema is just, it was something that I had worked out there and sort of knew kind of the places that I really wanted to focus on and, mm-hmm. and the mood I wanted to evoke and the actors and non-actors I wanted to put together mm-hmm. in the scenes and play off of each other to find something that was truthful yet said something about what the American dream has become in a way, mm-hmm. how it's changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you're starting to talk about your influences and your personal way in, I'm just curious, how did you enter, like, did you grow up around movies and where did you grow up? Did your parents introduce you to that or one of your parents? Or?
Actually, I came to cinema through music. The reason I was out on the farm is because we had a music collective, and the way I started making movies is because I would make these collage films, and we would project them on the wall in art galleries, and we would play the music behind the audiences too. And so we would play these live scores. Growing up, my parents really weren't cinephiles, I was kind of the typical kid. I'd go to the bigger movies, but most of my time was spent outside as an only child, with kind of using my imagination.
Sure.
And, you know, I had friends and everything, but it wasn't like I had like a big family, like where we could all go out. It was more just like me exploring nature by myself. And
right.
I mean, maybe that's how I got the overactive imagination.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah. And you could see it in Frank's character. What's his name?
Sal.
Mm-hmm. You can kind of see the, he spends a lot of time by himself in nature, so mm-hmm. it's not so surprising. I talked to Kelly Reichardt too, who you should meet.
I would love to meet her. That
Kelly,
would be a dream come true.
Kelly, note to self.
Yes,
I'll get you her email. She did. She had a different kind of a world, but or rather childhood. But she also explores that same kind of. The similar themes that we're talking about, you know, and about sort of the underbelly of America mm-hmm. and the open space. And she, I guess, had a police detective father or something. And
interesting,
I'm sorry, like the crime scene, like I'm trying to remember, like if she just saw it was at, you know, ended up seeing some crime scenes in her day. But she took a number of road trips with her mother, like extended road trips, like across great expanses of the United States. And
nice.
You could see in her films these being, you know, on the road, how that influenced her filmmaking. And she would take pictures as a little kid and on the road. So it's like, well, that's what you're still doing, you know.
That's a really good point, because my dad and I, we used to take trips, and he was a photographer. And so that was probably another way in to filmmaking. Was
sure.
He taught me a lot about composition and the rule of thirds, and like teaching without teaching. But it's where the photograph is divided into three horizontal sections, and you're sort of like the traditional classical composition is to frame like a certain way. And so he raised me kind of with those ideas for composition in mind, and then also how to expose, how to underexpose if you want to, how to use like slow and fast shutter speeds. And, and he would give me his Nikon I would take photos, and he would sort of like help me and show me like what different lenses did and all different kinds of stuff. So he was a huge influence on my film work. And he also gave me my first video camera right before I left college to go travel the world. I went and traveled and backpacked through South America and lived in South America for almost a year, and then went over to Europe and backpacked through Europe. And the whole time, that was where those video collages came from. That I used for the music and the compositions. And so it was all... Looking back on it, it all seems like it all makes sense, you know, in a weird way.
Some distance now that you're talking. Hey.
Yeah.
Well, this is not a therapy session.
Right.
But happy to help. Where did you grow up? Where was this taking place?
I grew up in Austin.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in... Okay. And I imagine even though you're a very young guy, I don't know if quite like Slacker had quite happened in those years yet, or maybe coinciding with that.
What year did it come out?
91 or 2, I don't
92,
know.
92, I think.
92, maybe.
Yeah, that was like the year, actually a couple of years after that, I left Dallas, left Austin and moved to Dallas and went to high school in Dallas. But that Austin is the Austin that I remember, which is why I love that movie so much.
Sure.
It was a very small town.
Yeah.
And it had a small town feel, and everyone talked with each other on this, you know, and it was a very personal, personally, it just felt good, like a small community. And I think that's what drew me to the small community that's in the film in Virginia, was just this idea of like kind of everyone looking out for each other, sharing meals, having long philosophical conversations, you know, just kind of on or off time instead of like watching television or, you know, sports or something like that.
Did you discover filmmakers and watching films like through just on your own then, like as a byproduct of gradual process or creative evolution, you know, like, I mean, I kind of did. So I don't think anybody pointed it out. I didn't go to film school, but I mean, it took decades to have that kind of, but I started with some of these same names, but those guys like Rafelson were, believe it or not, making movies when I was a kid. Like and there wasn't a big industry for children's movies. There were Disney movies, but there wasn't any Pixar. There wasn't any DreamWorks. There wasn't any whole industry. So we saw a lot of movies as young kids, teenagers. We saw the same movies that our parents were seeing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so my point is that I kind of had that head start in a way,
right,
with the classics, because the Altman movies were coming out, the Cassavetes movies were coming out, the Rafelson movies were coming out in those days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I would see them in the movie theaters, you know,
even though
I was probably too young to sit through some of these.
Right.
And, you know, and then you get the reference, oh, these guys were influenced by, let's say, Truffaut and Godard and all these other, you know, French filmmakers and Italian master, you know, Antonioni and all these other Fellini, and so I watched them all because of my parents loved them. So
yeah, well, for me it was those 3 years that I spent in the cabin that you see on the film, like with Sal, were very lonely years, and I would go to the library down in Blacksburg, which was about a 40-minute trip, and I would check out basically every movie that they had. And I didn't know any of these directors. Like, I watched my first Tarkovsky film without even knowing who he was. But I remember that, I mean, it was Solarius. And I remember watching it and saying, I have no, like, it just absolutely changed my entire perspective on what cinema could be. And I'm there. I am sitting on a in a cabin watching this on a laptop, you know, alone in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, and I'm looking outside and I'm like, this makes sense to me because this is basically like what's happening outside. Like there's some sort of magic that he's able to actually capture and bring into the cinema and take you there. And at the time I was doing a lot of, you know, experimental video and I was composing a lot of music, and I thought of cinema as the greatest art after I saw, you know, films like that, you know, films like Bresson, Bresson's films and, Antonioni's films, Kurosawa. I was watching a lot of Kurosawa because they had a lot at the library, and I would...
Yeah, it's really amazing stuff, right? When you start to dig deep into the Kurosawa stuff, it's...
Ikiru, there was a song, the song that he sings...
The Older Man?
The Older Man.
Yeah.
I covered that song at a show. Man. I did, and people really responded to it when he sing, like the song that he sings on the swing.
Yeah.
They really responded to it at a show that we played, and I was just so happy because I had no idea still who Kurosawa was, but that song affected me so deeply that I was like, I got to cover this song. So I learned it. I picked up my acoustic guitar, and it was like a classical acoustic guitar, so I picked it, and it was a beautiful thing. Mm. And I don't think anybody knew where that song came from.
Well, I'm sure. I mean,
maybe they
did. Even if they've seen the movie, it's still rather obscure.
Yeah. And so... Cinema, after that, I was like, I have to figure out how I can do this, like how I want to make films. I really don't care, like, if anything ever happens with them or whatever. But this, to me, is the epitome of art because it is visual, it's writing, it's music, it's sound. Like, it's the most complicated, most beautiful art form that there is. And I was like, this is what I want to devote my life to.
Mm. Well, good head start there, or rather, good start, I should say. You know, interesting was you were talking about like checking out movies from the library, and not really having a knowledge of the or context for the films. It's liberating because you don't go in with any like these are classics and these are because I never had that experience with a lot of these movies. Like by the time I got around to Tarkovsky, or you know, some of these other, you know, world cinema greats or whatever, you know, you're supposed to, like, these are the standard bearers and you have to, like, recognize their place in the history of world cinema, you know.
Sure.
So it's kind of neat to be able to not know any of that and be exposed and arrive exactly at where you're supposed to intellectually, emotionally watching it. And then you're your own judge of that, you know. You don't have to go in with a prejudice. And so I only get that when I'm given as a pre-screener sometimes. When I pre-screen for, like I did for a little bit for Tribeca, and now I do it for Rooftop. And nobody's seen these movies. Like, you don't know if you're watching the next groundbreaking director or something. So you have to just figure out, is this good or not, without any clues.
That was how I felt when I saw Young Bodies Heal Quickly. Did you see that one? And I watched it and I said, this is something that is just absolutely pure and beautiful. I have no idea where this came from, but I absolutely love it. And I want to see all of his movies. And we hosted Andrew at Oak Cliff Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And I had a great conversation with him about physicality of characters and about how in some beasts is like, I was like, I wanted to use that sort of as a mode of expression because it's like something that comes off. I think that Krisha, which by the way we saw.
Oh yeah.
Talk about a movie that uses physicality in a way that is just an art form in itself. Mm-hmm. I was just absolutely blown away with that movie. I want to see it again, and it's playing during my movie. So I may have to do it.
Head to head. Well, no, I mean, I know I was blown away and I was experiencing some family, very big of family issues, as I still am. But when there's a certain point where I just saw it coming, I'm like, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to handle this mode. I did not expect this very, very raw story. I didn't expect it. Mm-hmm. So when I was sitting, have you seen it?
Yeah,
you saw it together?
Yeah.
Yeah. but when I started, and it's from your neck of the woods too, right, Dallas?
Yeah.
So, oh no, Houston. Right, I keep forgetting. Uh-huh. So I kept, and I, at a certain point, I'm like, oh shit. And then they bring out the great grandmother, and I just lost it because she was just so, there was just something, and then Krisha's expression, and I've talked about the film already on this film, on this podcast, so, but it's glad finally, now it's starting to creep into the world slowly. I was hoping Trey Schultz might be here, but I don't think he's here. I haven't seen him.
I can't wait to meet him and just shake his hand and thank him for that movie.
Oh, wow, yeah. Well, if you're listening, there's another one. We'll have to make sure that he sees some beasts, so I'm sure he'll really love it. And I didn't want to, there are some other things going on with the film in terms of the storyline, but the truth of the matter is that it's, you just kind of have to see it. You don't want to give away. It's not like there's a big mystery to it, but you do understand the reference of the name at a certain point in the film late on, and mm-hmm. and there is a subplot involving a another younger, also I don't know, outlier type. What would you call him? He's like another outsider type.
He is. He's this young boy who's
runaway.
Runaway who seems like he's
in the woods.
Kind of moving from. He's either between living in the woods or kind of. Squatting in houses,
right?
Which I used to caretake houses when I was up there for families that were like away in the winter, and it was weird when you would hear a sound in a house, and you were kind of wondering if, you know, because there were people around who would find out that people were leaving and squat in houses, and so that was sort of where
that you know,
it's
a comedy,
okay.
But it's about these two guys who are, but they're it's in the Catskills, I think, and they're
okay.
They're not caretakers though. They break into houses and because everybody's away, you know, during the winter, and so. But anyway, they break into houses is my point, and you know, it's a comedy though because it's I guess you know it's the flip side of what you're talking about.
But that was it was an important thing because for me to sort of talk about on this film, there are a lot of kind of themes and ideas that played out over my time there that have made it into the film and that got cut from the film.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like music was a big part, and there is a part.
Yeah,
like,
I noticed that
with Gary when he's playing.
Yes.
In the barn.
Yeah.
Sort of this
really good music.
Very big moment and. And to me, there was another moment like where he was drumming that got cut, and it was a very intense sort of drumming scene, and it like played in sort of like intercut with this other scene. It was good, but it was one of those things where it.
Yeah. Would you to go back to Krisha? Did you think about this the way that you sound in that also, right?
Absolutely, there was like parts that reminded me of Punch Drunk Love.
That's the reference I bring up too.
But there was, that composer also, I believe, didn't he work on a teacher too? Pretty sure.
On which one?
On a teacher.
Oh, a teacher. Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah, and his scores have always just have blown me away. I mean, the way that he picks out instrumentation to sort of bring out parts of scenes is just, it's really, he's really intuitive. And there are composers and then there are film composers, and that he's a true film composer in that he sees the work and can actually like enhance the work. Mm-hmm. So I was very impressed. Yeah. And also the range, because he has some, you know, like there are cello glissandos that are just like very slow and, you know, very ambient. And then he has the complete opposite.
Right. Kind of jarring.
Jarring,
very intrusive level of noise, like Punch Drunk Love did.
Exactly,
constant basis. Yeah,
yeah, and it adds to the tension
so well, and as does the camera movement. I mean, which normally you might get, oh, it's too busy, but there's something about it works. The chaos that it brings and the tension, as you put it, it just was remarkable.
Yeah.
First time feature, also, it's just
yeah,
I don't know, like how they knew certain things would work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know? It was risky, and all the risks like totally paid off.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah. That's rare.
Yeah. So tell me where, I guess, Some Beasts will be. You mentioned a few more festivals coming up. You have a lot of festivals booked. It seems to be a very festival. No?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
So
we're out to a lot.
Never mind what I just ignore what I just said. Let's back up. So you kind of made it through. Have you done? You did a few though so far, right?
We've done Dallas. Nashville is like what we have so far.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're submitting still.
Yeah, we're definitely still in the submission stage, okay. And we're sort of we're being very careful about, you know, who we submit to, and just, you know, we want to definitely like have, the film is it's a slow art film, you know.
Yeah, sure.
It's but at the same time, it's for me and the feedback that I keep getting is it's one that needs to be seen on the big screen, and the DCP of this film and the 5.1 surround are so important to have the, it's an experiential film is another thing that I keep hearing. And I think that that's a big part of the experience. And so, having as many screenings in actual cinemas is going to be, I think, really important for
right,
us.
And well, the first part of that is obviously festivals, because there's no saying, you know, there's no, obviously, I don't know, no given for in terms of theatricals and all that. There's,
we have no, we're definitely, we understand the state of the theatrical. I mean, the good news is, though, is that we did do the IFP Narrative Film Labs, and so we're eligible to apply for the IFP Screen Forward. Which
exactly.
Yeah.
Which Leah Meyerhoff is going to be doing she's going to be showing Unicorns.
With Unicorns. That awesome. There. Yeah.
And L for Leisure is coming up, which is another great film from these LA guys.
Nice.
So, but, you know, that would be great. You know, we could probably help that along. You get the... Yeah. Whatever it's worth, the Filmax endorsement. I don't know if it'll be the final, but you know,
we're out to Rooftop too.
Okay. So. Did you have a short there ever?
I did not have a short. But
Krisha did play. It was a short first, and you said you saw that, right?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
And it played at Rooftop, so that I think that part of their agreement is that if you do a feature version, is it's you're playing it at Rooftop. It's sort of like
nice.
So
that's
will
great.
Be there. As well, and I've been in touch now with Krisha, who I met and had a nervous breakdown when I met her. So she now calls me the crying man. Cause,
oh wow!
But we had kind of all. I went to their little post party at lunch thing, and talked to her for a while, and we've since been in touch, like occasionally on you know social media, and then you know kind of writing notes to each other.
Nice.
So I hope that we get a chance to all meet again. She lives in Mexico.
Oh, okay.
She's sort of one of these expats who've, like, you know, moved down to Mexico, you know, and lives down there, makes baskets, that kind of thing, you know.
How interesting.
And, yeah, yeah.
So she's an actor?
She was, and I guess she's now coming back because I think she's getting calls, yeah. And her sister, who was not an actress, but she was just Dynamite, the one who plays Trey's mother, who's actually, plays his aunt.
Aunt, yeah.
In the movie, is actually his mother.
Oh, okay.
And Krisha's actually his aunt.
I see.
And plays his mother.
I see. Wow. How interesting.
And it was a real person in their family. It was a man.
Okay.
Who that was based on and who died.
Oh, wow.
So they were all coming off that as well.
Wow.
Like this family, and they made this film. So it's a pretty intense situation. And then, of course, they used some local actors.
Right.
Like Chris Dubeck and Bill Wise.
I love Chris Dubeck.
Yeah. And yeah, I have another episode to post with him from this South by with him and Bill Wise and Heather and Johnny. So it's nice to kind of just have eventually hear all the different perspectives on these film projects that are. I think there just seems to be a spate of great movies, and it's exciting to me. I'm at least a generation or two older than you are, but to see the. It's still every time to talk and find out the influences still, you know, everybody keeps coming back to these similar, you know. So all that says to me is not that everybody, you know, like I was suggesting earlier where you kind of told who you need to go to.
Right.
But I think it's a natural thing where you know, because they told real stories about, and it was all character driven and story driven.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately. And so even though a lot of filmmakers, quote unquote, sell out, I suppose, and make some Hollywood big, you know, blockbuster type film. But I think still in all, people go back to these stories, and we need these stories because it reflects the real human condition. And, you know, when you see it, it's a transcendent experience when you see it with like Some Beasts or Krisha or... King of Marvin Gardens, whatever it is, you know, it's like these are transcendent films. You come out changed, you know.
I think,
on some level,
there's an authenticity to them that just when I was growing up in the era of 80s and 90s movies, you know, they're harder to find in that era. And I feel like that's the reason why there's so many filmmakers from my generation who are going back to the 70s.
Yeah.
And we start, I feel like a lot of us start with the 60s, you know, like with the French New Wave and the then, Italian neorealism.
Sure,
you know? I mean, Rossellini has a huge part to play in Beast and sort of, Visconti and Bertolucci to some extent, you know.
He was on this too.
Really?
Yeah, believe it or not, I talked to Bertolucci.
That's amazing.
You have to go back and listen. Yeah.
That's amazing.
It was a Skype call, but. Yeah, he was at his new movie.
Wow.
He had a movie out recently. And it was
Is it the one with the brother and the sister?
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Iute.
I really wanted to see that, and it hasn't been... I don't know where
to get it. Oh, maybe. I don't know if it's available. You're right. But it was...
But he directed it like in a wheelchair, right? And that was like one of the big things I read in Film Comment was that he was...
Yeah, he had been sick, you know, and he retired. And then he just was, I guess, getting so depressed. He realized I can't keep going on like this. He said it in Italian, though.
Yeah.
And he said, and then so he finally just decided to do a little movie.
Right.
All inside of this, you know, basement, basically, of this house or building. And with these two characters and, you know, and it brought him back to life. He said, and it's meant, he doesn't care if people watch it on a computer or on a watch, he says.
Wow.
So he says. But,
the reason I brought it up is because, you know, there's usually so much motion in dollies and in this movie. And I hear that this is like one film where it's like there's a lot of static shots and a lot of just wide shots and it's very still.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was very interesting that, you know, you know, there's so many directors that like have a style, but like it seems to me like he's just staying true to who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, that was really refreshing to hear. It's nice.
Yeah. Well, he's made some very big, expansive movies.
I know.
So I think he probably tried to take that to the intimate story kind of approach. I don't know. Well, so hopefully we'll see you in New York in the summer.
Yeah, I would love to be there.
Nice meeting you.
It was great meeting you too.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. And we'll look for big things from you and from the film. And hopefully come back on.
Would love to do it.
Yeah.
That was great. Yeah. I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
Sure, thank you. Thank you, everybody. We're on Instagram, we're on Twitter, at Film Wax Radio. We are on Facebook, at facebook.com/Film Wax Radio, of course. We have a website, and it's called filmwaxradio.com. You can find episodes on iTunes, of course. Please go and subscribe. Leave us a nice comment and star rating. I always ask for that, but it's really important. And also, we are available for streaming off of Stitcher and YouTube as well. And I'm going to be looking soon to get us on Spotify and SoundCloud and everything else, but baby steps. Be back in a few days with a brand new episode, of course. Who's coming up here? We've got another wonderful episode coming up with... I've got Karen Cooper, who has been with Film Forum forever. We've got episode coming up with Bob Hawke, film champion extraordinaire. We've got... Abel Ferrara still to post. I've got WFMU personality Clay Pigeon and filmmaker Rachel Schumann, who have a documentary out called One October. We'll be posting that shortly. Their film is about to go to the Lighthouse International Film Festival as well as the Cape Cod Film Festival, so we're going to get that up in a little bit. Leo Wachowski and Todd Soliday with their new documentary. It's called Big Sonia. Very entertaining film. And can't wait to play that for you, along with Women You Should Know, which is an organization which basically champions projects by women. And then they have another area called another component to their business called Women You Should Fund, which is now a new crowdsourced platform, which Big Sonia is taking advantage of right now. We'll tell you more about that in the next episode or two of the podcast. Also coming up is Lorenzo Fiuzzi, who is this nice young Italian gentleman who has a streaming platform, which we're going to tell you all about, called Cinematique. And you can subscribe to it for a very low fee and see all these great international films that you don't get to see anywhere else because they often don't even get to the United States. It's a fantastic idea.
And we'll have Lorenzo on in the, I think maybe either the next episode or the one just after. We're going to get those up. Then we also have an entire episode devoted to the recent Maryland Film Festival, just finished a few days ago, including interviews with Skiz Sizek and Eric Hatch, who are with the festival. I've got another interview from there with Stanley Nelson, who is returning to the podcast with his new documentary, Tell Them We Are Rising, The Story of Black Colleges and Universities. Also a young filmmaker from Baltimore named Theo Anthony, who has this amazing film, which you're going to hear a lot about as it comes into New York this summer, called Rat Film. And we have him coming up on the show. And then a little bit down in the next few weeks, we're also going to have Lara Stallman, who is the filmmaker behind a new documentary called Swim Team. So, guys, you know, I'm doing my best here to bring in as many interesting folks as possible to the show. So continue to please stay tuned to the show. And the best way, again, is going on iTunes and subscribing. Thank you very much. FilmWax Radio is part of the Showbriz Studios podcast network. You should check them out. They've got a bunch of great shows, including The David Feldman Show. There's The Carson Show, which is a podcast devoted to bringing on guests who all knew Johnny Carson. And each episode is there these amazing anecdotes. So check out that. And there's got a bunch more shows, all part of the Showbriz Studios podcast network. And then we're also presented by Rooftop Films, our friends and partners at the Rooftop Films, which, again, opens their 21st season tomorrow night at the Old American Can Factory here in Squamish, Brooklyn. So we'll see you there. I'll be there and this weekend, and I look forward to seeing everybody. Okay, everybody, take care of yourself, please, and the ones you love. Till next time.